So I want to share with you a little bit about the life of the Buddha. And Sean and Bruce, I think, are the only people here who saw a version of this because it came about through a yeah, look at that. Okay, one more step. Came about through a the I can do this, the Buddhist Essentials. We had a Buddhist Essentials class, and we started off with Life of the Buddha, and it just sort of evolved. Why don't we do a visual? So we did a visual and just with 20 minutes, and so people there liked it, so I said, hey, we should do it here. So it's a little different. In the past, I've been to India a few times, five times, so I've done sort of pilgrimage slideshows, but this is like trying to the life of the Buddha using some of these images and some other images, mostly stuff I took, but also a little bit from Wiki Commons. So I'm just going to talk you through this, and if you have any questions in the way, stick your hands
Maybe
up.
Wikipedia.com.
Can you guys see me? Okay. Yeah. No, I can't see you out there, so if something goes wrong, yell at me, okay? Out there in Zoom world, I can just see a little bit. So you do like Kathy in particular, or whoever.
Yeah, I'll
Okay.
say something.
Can you see the image okay though of the map? Cool. All right. And you two, everybody good? All right. So the one thing I can't quite figure out is, oops. Guess that's good enough. Okay. So the Buddha started off with a map. The Buddha lived most of his life crisscrossing the Ganges Valley. So it's northern India. And the Ganges comes out down here in Calcutta. So in this area, mostly by foot, teaching the Dharma to people he encountered. And 2,600 years ago, this area wasn't India, but it was a bunch of kingdoms. It was a whole bunch of kingdoms, nor was there Nepal. And in particular, when you read the suttas, the Magadhas and the Kosala kingdoms and the Sakyas were smaller. He was from the Sakya clan, and then the Visayan Republic. They all appear in the suttas. And it's interesting and relevant to our situation now that we were just talking about is that this wasn't actually necessarily a fun time to be there. There was warfare. The Magadhas, they conquered the Visayans later on. And these kingdoms played a key role in the life of the Buddha. And it was the political world around him was fraught with complication and deceit mixed with kindness, just like now, right? And two of his greatest lay followers were King Bimbisara, who was king of the Magadha kingdom, and King Pasenadi, king of the Kosala kingdom. And there's some amazing suttas in which there's exchanges with those two. And ironically, both of those kings were deposed by their sons during the Buddha's lifetime. So I can just imagine what that was like. These are the people that had supported you, and their sons deposed them. And first one was Bimbisara, and his son ended up starving him to death in a prison not far, as you'll see, from the bamboo grove, which is mentioned often in the suttas. Oh, I cut my finger, so I'm bleeding now, but that's fun. And then when King Pasenadi was deposed, he actually went to beg for help from the son who had overthrown his dad. I think he died anyway. So just saying that there was, if we think that it was like, oh, an idyllic, peaceful time the Buddha was in, it was not in many ways. And he spent his life, last map, kind of in this circumference. It's the same thing we're looking at. We see Lumbini's over the border into Nepal. That's where he was born. Kapilavastu over in this area was the capital of his father's small kingdom, or what exactly it was. It wasn't really a kingdom, but within the larger kingdom where he grew up. and also the location of Jetavana Monastery, which we'll be seeing later, which is where the Buddha was more time than anywhere else. Then we also see Bodh Gaya down here in what is now Bihar, where he awakened, and Sarnath over here, right next to Varanasi, where he first taught, and Kushinagar up here, where he died. And basically, this is now Bihar, and this is Uttar Pradesh, as you can see on this map. Bihar and Uttar Pradesh, two very large and very, among the most, the poorest states in India. So during his 40 years of sharing the Dharma, he crisscrossed the region. He just went back and forth quite a bit. Pretty much, as far as we know, basically on foot. You know, asking for alms along the way, practicing along the way. He went a lot between Jetavana Monastery and then this area here, Vulture Peak, and the bamboo groves, about 350 miles. So he covered some ground. Now, he was born in Lumbini, which is just across the border into Nepal, and his mother was traveling back to Kapilavastu to give birth after visiting relatives because she was pregnant, but she didn't make it all the way and had him hanging onto a tree in Lumbini and then died 7 days later. And he was actually brought up by his stepmother. So this is one of the places where people do pilgrimage. And this structure here houses the archaeological digs from where he, perhaps where he was born and monasteries and things after that. I have not been here. But this is the Mayadevi Temple, and there's ruins underneath, and there's a whole bunch of stupas and monasteries and stuff all around Lumbini. If you ever want to go, it's easier to get there from Kathmandu. I still may do it, rather than trying to get across the border from India. He was brought up in prosperous conditions in Kapilavastu, where his father was hoping to entice the Buddha to follow in his footsteps and run the kingdom or minor kingdom, whatever it was. And these are ruins from there. And this may have been one of the palaces. The Buddha talks about it in the, he describes in some detail in the suttas, the delicacy, because he uses the word delicacy translated into English to be sure, but of his life. He said he wore only fine silks from Varanasi, lived in three palaces. I thought the thing about wearing only fine silks from Varanasi, it's like it rang true, you know, because he would know about that. And he had three palaces, and he talks about the different colored lotuses in the different ponds of the palaces, and he was entertained by only female dancers and singers. So he had an extravagant and somewhat hedonistic early life. And it was also during this period, something you read about in the suttas, that the Buddha had kind of a spiritual opening under a rose apple tree. I've ever read about that when he, basically, the story goes that his father was doing some ceremonial plowing, just like the beginning of the planting season, and the Buddha, young boy, sitting 7 or 8 years old, was sitting underneath a rose apple tree. He was a, you know, well-fed royalty, basically, just kind of relaxed, and he fell into concentration. He just fell into concentration, probably the first or second jhana, and felt this great happiness and this great peacefulness that was really important later on in terms of him finding the path. So this kind of happened at this time in his life somewhere not far from here. And he was being groomed to take over the kingdom, but he gradually saw through the transitory and unsatisfactory nature of all these entertainments. And so eventually he left the palace in his 30s and all the trappings of power and worldly pleasure and went off on his spiritual quest. And oh, by the way, there's a really interesting book called The Buddha's Wife that came out quite recently, written by a very feminist, very smart Buddhist practitioner in the Bay Area. It's really great, with an incredibly alternative interpretation of a significant part of his life, and I won't give away the punchline, but it's really good, and she's very fiery, but also incredibly beautiful in how she expresses it and has a deep knowledge of the Dharma that just permeates it. So it's unusual, and she, to be sure, a lot of it's fictionalized, but it's all locked in the context of the suttas. So it's a fascinating book. Okay, so his 6 long years included extreme asceticism. And there's not many of these statues around, because this isn't the awakened Buddha. This was the almost awakened Buddha. And you can see these in different places. I saw one in Thailand like this. And his body was so starved, he said, he could touch his backbone from the front. His eyes were sunk down like in the sockets. His skin was falling off. This is when he was with the five ascetics. And he was almost dead. I mean, he was eating like, allegedly, a grain of rice a day. That may be a metaphor, but nonetheless, not much. But it was during this period that he had this recollection. I mean, he was like literally near death. And he had this recollection of this moment under the rose apple tree and went, wait a minute, that was happy. And that wasn't bad. That wasn't anything to avoid. Maybe there's a different alternative. And so he had this epiphany and had a breakthrough and decided there must be a middle way and started eating again. At which point his five ascetics decided he was a glutton and a slug and ran off and turned their backs on him. But he was restored to health. And he sat under the Bodhi tree. And this is not the Bodhi tree, but a descendant of the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. So this is still where the Buddha, you know, allegedly was awakened. There's something called the Diamond Throne down under there, where supposedly is marks where he sat. But it's an extraordinary place, Bodh Gaya. If you ever get a chance to go, just pilgrims from all over the world, they're all circumambulating. Well, you know, a lot of Westerners, but not a lot of Westerners, some Westerners. Tons of Asian Buddhists of all stripes. It's just really, it's really moving. So he determined to awaken at a certain point and sat under the Bodhi tree and had this intense night, this all-night battle with Mara, sort of symbolizes temptation, tempted him in every way possible with undulating maidens and fiery armament coming at him, and every fear or diversion he might have, but he persevered and was awakened. And this tree, by the way, was grown from a cutting. There was a cutting taken by King Ashoka, whose son went to Sri Lanka about 200 years after the death of the Buddha, and there's a big Bodhi tree there, and then took a cutting of that and brought it back here, and that's where this one comes from, is my understanding. So after he awakened, he took seven steps. Right after he's awakened, and this whole area is right around the corner. The Bodhi tree's over here. This is over here. This is the Mahabodhi Stupa. Took seven steps, and people do all this incredible. Groups of pilgrims will decorate this with all these garlands and things. It's really amazing what people do. So this sort of symbolizes this area where he supposedly took his first steps after his awakening. And then this is the Mahabodhi Stupa. The tree is right behind it, and this is sort of the center of pilgrimage for Buddhists all over the world. To go to the Mahabodhi Stupa is really wonderful. Inside, there's a statue of the Buddha, which is amazing, in this fairly small room. So people are stuffed in there. There's actually a room up above where, I didn't know this, someone just told me the other day, Lee Brazenton said that he figured out the signal to get up there and go be able to meditate. So there is a room up above. But it's amazing to go there, and there's this real sense of commitment by pilgrims from all over the world. You know, you can see there's people who are circumambulating all around this outer perimeter. Then they're circumambulating on this layer and around here. So this is sort of up. We're up sort of on a level, right? The Mahabodhi Stupa, we're sort of in it right now. And you just get in. I ended up sitting next to this monk for hours, and it's really just so extraordinary. It kind of transcends, you know, different nationalities. So very much alive. So within weeks after his awakening, the Buddha is like these stories that, you know, they may be metaphoric or whatever, but he struggled with whether or not he could teach. What he tuned into was so different than what the current sense of spiritual direction was, that he doubted it was even worth trying. It would just be a bother. No one would get it. But supposedly these Brahman came and said, oh no, you must go teach, and there will be people with little dust in their eyes. So after thinking about teaching his first two teachers, he found out they both died. Devas kept popping up and saying, nope, that person just died last night. So then he decided to go where the five ascetics were, the people who had abandoned him because he was a slothful glutton. So he walked 150 miles to Sarnath, which is right outside Varanasi. So that's quite a little journey. And he didn't have, you know, he knew in his mind's eye where they were. And he just shows up and they're there, which is kind of cool. So no cell phones. And it's there where he first taught the Dharma, the first turning of the wheel. And for centuries, there was a stupa right here. This was called the Dharmajika Stupa until sadly was torn down in the 17th century by a Maharaj for building stones to build a fruit market in Varanasi. But nonetheless, there was a huge stupa here symbolizing where he did the first turning of the wheel, the very first teaching, where he taught about the middle way, taught about the Four Noble Truths. It's an amazing sutta tucked in there. And as the story goes, when he showed up, the five ascetics were still there, all as skinny as he had been. And they went, oh, look, there's a Buddha. There's the glutton. Forget him. We're not going to stand up. And then he came closer and he was so radiant they couldn't do anything else. And they did. And even in the first teaching, one of them became stream entry just from the teaching. And the second teaching was at the Dhammek Stupa, which is this one, which was not torn down, where he taught the Anatalakaha Stupa, which I just mangled, but nonetheless, about not self. And at this one, all five of them woke up. Now we're in Sarnath. It's one of the four pilgrimage places just outside Varanasi, about 5 miles. Just a wonderful place. It's all preserved, and there's all these gardens and lawns and all these ruins of monasteries. You really get in your heart that people were here for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, there's monasteries here. Good question. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Quite old, but I don't know. Yeah. It has survived, and I think it was one of those, you know, it's a ton of this stuff during the, you know, not so great period of British colonialization. Nonetheless, a slight fringe benefit was there was a ton of archaeological work done. There's a great book about I can't remember the title of it now, but how they found all this stuff. And it was all these archaeologists, British archaeologists, who figured it out slowly because it was all lost and nobody had a clue what this was at that point. The Hindus didn't care. But it's an amazing sight, and again, pulls people from all over Asia. With great reverence, here's this man bowing in front of the stupa. And it just really touches your heart. And just about 200 years after, this is an Ashokan pillar. You can see writing on it. Some of you may know that Emperor Ashoka became converted to Buddhism 250 years and spread Buddhism all over Asia. And if it was not for him, it's hard to say if Buddhism would be what it is now, because he planted these pillars everywhere and sent to Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia and was extraordinary and had a very long reign, a very peaceful reign. And India was a very peaceful place during that period. So this is one of the Ashokan pillars. And again, you can see these are groups of pilgrims. It's like probably Sri Lankan. Maybe they're all dressed in white and here's a monk teaching them. So there's all these different groups from everywhere, and also some Indian people, because it's also, for Indian people, it's more like, you know, a tourist place. But very beautiful. It's called Deer Park, by the way. If you read the sutta, it's called Deer Park, and there's actually a whole bunch of deer back in here in a kind of a pen. But nonetheless, there's deer. And the third sutta that has an actual place, the fire sermon, very famous fire sermon, this was given on this hill outside of Gaya. And Gaya is about 12 miles from Bodh Gaya. It's a much bigger city. And it's in Bihar, very difficult. It's all these warnings, don't go from Gaya to Bodh Gaya in the middle of the night because there's thieves. But nonetheless, this is where he gave the fire sermon. And he gave it to a bunch of people who had been rag-wearing fire worshiper Hindu folks. So that's why he used the metaphor of fire to talk about samsara in a very piercing way, because that was his audience. It really makes sense, because it's a really strong Hindu area that he was, this part of Bihar and the Ganges Valley. So it really made sense that he really had to speak to them in their language. And I'm going to, a few things from the middle of his life is what I'm going to share here. You've probably heard of Vulture Peak. Heart Sutra. This is where he did it. This is Vulture Peak. And way down here is where the buses come in and the vehicles and stuff. I mean, it's a pilgrimage place. And I got some hot tips, like go there early. So if you ever go there, got a car. It's not that far from Bodh Gaya. Got a car at 5 a.m., showed up in the dark, and got me up here. I was the first person to get up here, which is really good because big buses were pulling in. So being the first person there was great because I was all alone up here, and it was really wonderful. But this is where the Buddha taught the Heart Sutra, you know, among other things. And he also went up here and practiced a lot. It pops up in the suttas repeatedly. He goes up here. I mean, he was really doing some climbing. But when it's funny about the Heart Sutra, when you read it more in the Mahayana world, what they talk about is all these devas and bodhisattvas are floating in the air. And actually, there's no choice. There's like, it's a cliff. I mean, there's not room for hardly anybody up there. You could probably fit 20. So I kind of got it. It was very interesting. And just below, like literally right 100 yards around the corner, is the Boar's Cave. And this is where Sariputta, which was one of the Buddha's two, Sariputta and Moggallana, are his two chief disciples. And this is where Sariputta awakened. And the Buddha also practices in this cave sometimes. So it's like, wow, you know, that's a cave where the Buddha practiced. That's so amazing. And then for those of you who do read the suttas, this is the mango grove. And it's not that far away. I mean, it's a matter of miles, maybe 5 or 6 miles from Vulture Peak is up here, kind of up this way. And this was offered by the physician, the doctor of King Bimbisara, offered the mango grove. And this is where the Buddha taught a lot. And a lot of those, quite a number of suttas are in the mango grove. And not far from here, I mean, literally like a mile away, is the prison where King Bimbisara starved to death. So it's just, it may well have been that he was there when the king was starving a mile away. Kind of blows my mind. And the other one, even more well-known, is the bamboo grove, which pops up even more constantly. And this very tank, they call it, but this very tank, the Buddha bathed there. So, and, you know, some version of it. But it's pretty cool. Really, really gives it sort of this tactile sense. And this was donated by King Bimbisara himself, the bamboo grove. But the Buddha kept being drawn back to his homeland, 350 miles to the west. So more than any one place, he went to Jetavana Monastery. And this is Anapanakati's Park. Anyway, it was given to him by a merchant who was totally smitten by what the Buddha was doing and wanted to buy this from some kind of prince. And he had to, like, you know, allegedly layer it with gold to buy it for the Buddha. So who knows? But anyway, it's an amazing, amazing, amazing place. It's pretty hard to get to. It's like 50 kilometers from the nearest railroad station. And it's just way up in Bihar. And it's just a super poor area. I mean, it's freaky getting there. It's just, the roads are just horrendous. And go through these villages where there's like no cars. I mean, it's rough. It's difficult. So, but once you get there, it's just, I mean, for India, you know, there's no people. To have an expanse of grass with no people. And also not being, because it's just sort of far away. It's like there weren't any. I was there for several days and nobody hassled me. No any beggars. There was a couple of bunch of, it was a park. It's Indian archaeological, it's a government maintained place. So there were guards and stuff and they kept things in line. But it was just an amazing place. You could go off in a tree and sit for hours. You know, it's pretty cool. And there's monasteries around. Anyway, this is where he completed 24 rains retreats. So out of 40 years, 24 rains retreats were here. So more than anywhere else. And just especially the middle length discourses, well, technically 871 suttas were offered here out of 871 suttas. So this is more than anywhere else he was here. And it's kind of funny because this isn't one of the normal pilgrimage places. I mean, it is an important pilgrimage place, but it's not the four. But it was so incredible because you could just feel, you know, oh my God, any place you sat, he'd walk back and forth there like hundreds of times or whatever. So it does draw pilgrims, just fewer of them. And here's this group of Sri Lankan pilgrims who had this unbelievably orchestrated thing they did, putting down marigold petals to make this eight-spoked wheel of the Dharma. And it was hot. And they had rehearsed this puppy because they just did it so fast and it was so perfect. It was just the damnedest thing. So pilgrims show up and do incredible stuff like this. Lots of Sri Lankan pilgrims. You can, and they kind of look like they're India because it's the same ethnic group, kind of, but it's a real different vibe.
These are just the ruins of walls.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think, right. I mean, we're talking 2,500 years, you know, so there were monasteries and things built and rebuilt, and there's stuff being restored as we speak. And to what degree it's being fabricated or restored, I don't know. But at least it's, the place is right. And that's about, yeah, exactly. And this is, speaking of, who knows what exactly that is, but this is the site, anyway, of his kuti, of the Buddha's kuti. And you know, why not? It seems like that they got that nailed. So this was the Buddha's main kuti at Jetavana Monastery. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't this big thing. It was his kuti, but it's called a Mulaganda kuti. And people from all over the world come in various ways to offer. And you can see this little funny little stupa here. It's all covered with gold leaf. And there'll be groups of pilgrims coming and going and coming and going and offering flowers. And here's a guy, you can see his microphone. He's doing some kind of Dharma talk for this group of pilgrims. So there's just groups like that going in and out all the time. But it's really sweet. It's really beautiful. And there's also this right next to it. I mean, that is right like over here. And this is supposed to mark where the Buddha did walking meditation. I don't know why it's up, but anyway, this is a place where the Buddha did walking meditation at Jetavana Monastery. And also there, this is a descendant of the Bodhi tree. So descended from the one, probably from the one in Sri Lanka, I don't know, but a lot of, you can sort of see there's all these prayer flags all over the place and prayer flags up there. And there was this one gentleman, again, with great reverence, just touching his head. This might have been a lifetime goal to go to this place for someone. You know, you really felt, I mean, a lot of these people, they're not wealthy. You know, they can't just like fly around the world like we kind of can. So it was very moving. You could just see how hard people had tried. But it's funny. I mean, this area, this is like, that's how it is right outside the monastery. It just felt like, oh, hasn't changed much in 2,600 years. You know, there's some cows out there and there's some fields off in the distance. And it was pretty quiet. There was even, to be sure, that's some kind of rubber tires, but still, ox-drawn carts, you know, probably hasn't changed much either. So it's a very poor part of India. Now this is a, some of you may know about Angulimala, who was, yeah, Angulimala, it means, mala is necklace, and Anguli means fingers. And he had a necklace of fingers because he was perhaps history's first serial killer. And he had killed 999 people and struck terror through the area. And this was around the area of Jetavana, kind of in that region, the story goes. And so everybody was afraid of him. He just was incredibly powerful or wicked or whatever he was. And he's off in the forest, and the Buddha said, I'm going to go over there. And people said, no, don't, you'll be killed. And he said, no, I'm going to go over there. And I was like, oh my God. Consternation and worry, because the Buddha was walking right into the, nobody would go with him because they'd sent armies after him. He took them all out. So we could roll with the hyperbole. Who knows? But there's something there. Anyway, it's kind of a cool story because the Buddha goes, Angulimala tries to chase him with his sword. He's going to get his thousandth finger and he can't seem to catch him. He can't seem to get him. And he says, Buddha, stop. Or whoever you are, stop. And the Buddha says, no, you stop. And he got it. And he decided to stop and took robes, didn't totally get away with it because he got stoned several times by angry people who figured out who he had been. But nonetheless, he became an arhat, an awakened being, and this is his stupa. And so I always think that's, you know, good to keep in mind anytime we think we're too much of a train wreck to ever awaken, that Angulimala was much worse. You're welcome. Oh, goodness. And we're almost at the end here. Buddha's life ended in Kushinagar, which is halfway between these two major sites. He was walking. It was sort of like the near the end. There was both of his sponsors had been, the major sponsors had been killed. He was old. He was with Ananda, his attendant, but he was kind of on his own a little bit. I don't quite get that. And he said in the for those of us who have white hair, he said his body was breaking down. It was like an ox cart held together with leather straps. I always love that image. I feel a little bit like that sometimes. He said he was like an ox cart held together with leather straps. And he chose this place between some sol trees to die. And Ananda protested, it's just little wattle huts. What an inappropriate place for the Buddha to die. And he said, no, this once was a great powerful place with shining palaces. And now, sure, it's like that, but everything's impermanent anyway, so it's okay. This stupa, I believe, holds some of its ashes. And this building here holds this amazing 36-foot long statue of the reclining Buddha as he lay down to die, which was hidden for centuries until during this archaeological period they found it. And the government of India built this curious but effective building over it. And by the way, there's a ubiquitous monastery foundations all around. And people come from around the world to... It's just an amazing place. I was really moved. It just has this sort of hush over it all the time. And people come in, lots of tour buses coming and, you know, pilgrim buses, better put it that way, pilgrim buses coming and leaving. I spent a whole day kind of tucked in this corner right over here, backed into the corner of my sitting cushion. And it'd be like 400 people in the building and then nobody and then 400 people and nobody. But it was just amazing. You know, and people would bring these shawls. They kind of did this whole, they rehearsed, I think, back wherever they came from, different groups, but they had all these embroidered shawls and they'd pull them over and do ceremonies and they'd leave and someone else would come. And they ended up being piled with shawls like that. This is a statue and all these people, I don't know, I think these were Japanese people here, that particular moment. And towards the end of his life, he continued to express compassion. I think it was really beautiful. It was Kunda, the goldsmith who made the food that may have killed him. But he said not to feel blamed. He said, no, only I can eat that. And he ate some of it. Then got food poisoning. And he said, no, go throw that away. And it hissed. Something was so wrong with it. But he said, no, you shouldn't blame yourself because Kunda had been really generous in the past. And he on purpose went and talked to him and said, no, it's okay. This is what was supposed to happen. So he kind of took him off the hook in case he felt bad about it. And then this mendicant says in the suttas, Sabada appeared at the last minute, and even on his deathbed, Ananda said, no, go away. The Buddha's dying. And the Buddha's wait overheard and said, no, have him come, and he gave him instructions. Last person he taught was this person who just appeared out of nowhere. And as you likely know, his final words were, all things are impermanent. Strive for the goal with diligence. And this stupa was built on the site of his cremation, or there was a stupa there once. Now there's kind of a ragtag pile of bricks, but nonetheless, there was a stupa there once. And this half smile on the statue kind of captures how his life ended, you know, with this sort of half smile. I think that's wonderful. Oh, so why don't we just pause for a second here?